several months earlier. Shizu eyed the lodge in front of her through the curtain of falling snow. Inside that building was the man she had come to kill. All she had to do in order to complete her contract was to enter the house, kill its occupant, and get out again without being caught. Not a problem, she thought with a grin. She circled the property, noting the position of the security cameras and how often they moved in their preset arcs, and laughed silently. Whoever was in charge of security was an idiot. The cameras moved in defined, repeatable patterns. All she had to do was wait for the right moment. When it came, she raced across the lawn directly toward the house in front of her. She was dressed in white from her head to her feet, blending perfectly with the snow all around her. Even if someone had chosen that moment to look out through the windows, they wouldn't have been able to pick out her form in the midst of the swirling snow. She reached the side of the building without incident and flattened herself against it. The cameras only faced outward, so she was beyond their reach, but she wasn't certain yet if there were armed guards wandering the property, and she didn't want to make herself a visible target. There was a door several yards farther along. From the plans she had stolen from the contractor who'd built the place, she knew that it led into a utility room. It was as good a choice as any to provide her entrance. She removed an electric lockpick from the pocket of her coat. It resembled a pistol, but instead of a barrel, it had a long, thick tongue sticking out of the front end. She shoved the tongue into the lock and then pulled the trigger. The pick vibrated inside the lock, causing the pins to fall into place, and then the door was opening before her. She shoved the pick back inside her jacket and stepped forward. Slipping inside, she shut the door quietly behind her and listened, making certain that the rattle of the pick, quiet as it was, had not attracted undue attention. She left her coat and shoes behind, not wanting the heavy fabric or wet soles to give her away. On stocking feet, she moved deeper into the house. The utility room door opened to a short corridor. It led into the kitchen. That was where she found the first guard. He was standing at the island, making a sandwich, a loaf of bread and a jar of mayonnaise open on the counter in front of him. He never heard her as she crept up behind him. She drove a knife deep into his brain through the base of his skull. She then lowered him quietly to the floor. Wiping the blade of her knife on his shirt, she moved on. The next guard was standing in a pool of light at the foot of the stairs leading to the second floor, his arms crossed in front of him. She carefully drew her sword from the scabbard she wore on her back. The dragon burst out of the hallway, a shadow moving through the dimly lit room. The guard died with his hands still reaching for the weapon on his hip when the dragon's sword was thrust through his heart. Pulling her sword free from his chest, she moved past the body and up the stairs. She could see the floor plan in her mind. She knew that the bedroom she wanted was the third door on the left. She was already passing through it into the room itself when someone found the body in the kitchen. But that didn't matter. She was where she needed to be. She could see the man's sleeping form on the bed in front of her, and she moved forward confidently. One more thrust would be all it took. 3 steps from the bed, the lights suddenly flared to life around her, and Shizu found herself looking down the barrel of the pistol held in the hand of the man on the bed, the one she had been sent here to kill. Staring at him, Shizu nearly died of shock. The man on the bed was Sensei.
Hello, Shizu. You did exceptionally well. While I know your skills are extraordinary, I did not think you could penetrate my security so easily. My hat is off to you and your teachers. I am sorry I had to test you this way, but it was necessary. I needed to be certain that you had developed the skills for what comes next, and this was the only way to do that. Do you understand that this was just a test? You are not to complete the mission as instructed, now that you know it is a test.
Shizu slowly nodded.
Let me hear you say it.
This mission is aborted. You are not the target.
Very good, Shizu.
Sensei finally lowered the pistol and placed it on the bed beside him.
Well done, Shizu. Well done, indeed.
But I could have killed you.
You could have tried. I give you that.
Sensei reached out and pressed a button on the intercom beside the bed. A moment later, the door behind Shizu opened, revealing a muscular man in a dark suit.
Show her to her room and see to it that she has anything she needs.
Yes, sir.
Get some rest. I'm sure your exertions tired you out. We will talk in more detail in the morning.
Mystified, but obedient as always, Shizu did as she was told. By the time she awoke the next morning, the damage to the estate had been repaired. She walked through the central room and saw no sign that she had killed a man there the night before. Even the bloodstains were gone from the thick carpet. Hungry, she wandered into the kitchen. There she found breakfast prepared, a buffet-style table laid out with fruit, eggs, meat. On the same island, the guard had been using to make a sandwich the night before. A place setting had been laid out, and next to her plate was a small card.
Join me in the dojo when you are finished.
There were a few other instructions on the card. It was unsigned, but Shizu had no problem recognizing the handwriting. She hadn't seen it in some time, but that didn't matter. One does not forget the signature of the man you consider to be your personal savior. The dojo was in a separate wing of the house, and it didn't take her long to find it. She moved directly to the changing room as she'd been instructed. There she found a large tub filled with water and a pure white kimono made from the finest silk hanging on a rack nearby. A full-length mirror stood next to the tub beside a small table holding a silver pitcher, a folded towel, a natural sponge, and another card.
Cleanse yourself and meet me on the floor when you are ready.
If Sensei wills, so be it, she thought. She stripped out of her clothing and carefully placed it off to the side so it wouldn't get wet. She caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror as she did so, her tattoo rippling across her muscles as she moved. She was not a vain woman, however, and the idea of standing in front of a mirror admiring herself was outside of her frame of reference. Picking up the pitcher, she poured the contents, water hot enough to still be steaming, all over her head and body. She endured it stoically, not flinching once at the pain. She put the pitcher down, picked up the sponge, and scrubbed herself clean. She turned to the tub. A stool stood nearby, and she used it to get up over the edge of the waist-high tub, then dropped down into the water. As she had expected, it was icy cold. She dunked beneath the surface three times, then climbed back out again, drying off with the towel before putting on the kimono. It fit as if it had been tailored for her, and Shizu had no doubt that it was indeed the case. She spent a few minutes clearing her head and preparing for what was to come. Finally, she stepped through the door into the dojo proper. In the middle of the room, Sensei waited, kneeling on a mat in front of a traditional Japanese tea set. He wore a black silk kimono the same color as his hair, which was loose around his face. It made him look younger, less harsh. Behind him, on a wooden rack, was a sword in a wooden scabbard. Shizu's curiosity burned at the sight of the weapon, but she knew better than to ask about the sword. It wasn't the way these things were done. She would remain quiet until Sensei mentioned it, or until she was given permission to speak freely. She crossed the floor on bare feet and settled down lotus style next to the tea set. As she reached out to begin the tea service, Sensei shook his head, indicating that she should leave the service alone. When she sat back, he shocked her by preparing the tea himself, something he had never done in front of her before. First, he added hot water to the delicate porcelain cups, and then added some green tea leaves. Next, he whisked the mixture together to produce a foamy green tea. Turning the cup to face her, Sensei bowed low and offered her the first taste. She took it then offered it back to him, as was traditional, but he declined, indicating she should drink. Once she had, he repeated the process. Taking a sip for himself before putting the cup down on the table. They passed another moment in silence.
You have done well, Shizu. I am proud of your accomplishments. Now, at last, we come to the reason for all you have done over the past several years. I have a specific mission for you. A mission I'm now convinced you can carry out successfully.
Whatever you wish, Sensei.
You have always been faithful, Shizu, and I admire you for that. Such dedication is a rare and powerful thing. Because you have been so devoted, so unflinching in all that you have done for me, today, I want to return that dedication. I have a gift for you, a gift fitting for one known as the Dragon.
Sensei stood and turned to the sword rack behind him. He bowed low, then picked up the scabbard in both hands and returned to his former position, the sword resting across his knees.
Like you, this sword was crafted for a purpose. The artisan who fashioned it poured everything he had into its creation. He gave it a destiny, and then turned it loose in the world to carry out its ends. So it is fitting that on this day, when you too are turned loose to carry out your mission, you should receive a gift of equal value.
To Shizu's shock and surprise, Sensei bowed once, short and sharp, and then handed her the sword. She cradled it lovingly in her hands, not trusting herself to speak. Holding the scabbard in one hand and grasping the hilt with the other, she drew the sword out slightly, revealing about 4 or 5 inches of the blade. The katana was old, she could tell just by looking at it. The blade was too sharp, the etching too exquisite, for it to have been made in the modern era. Toshiro had taught her to recognize the old blades, those actually fashioned during the samurai period itself, and she had no doubt that this one originated from that time frame. Just beneath the hilt, a dragon had been etched lovingly into the blade's surface. It was lunging forward, its front claws reaching toward the pointed end of the blade, smoke pouring from its mouth and between its whiskers.
It hungers, Shizu. Hungers for death and destruction and misery. Hungers for everything its creator wished upon his enemies. It is the sword carried by your predecessor, the original dragon. Now, it is yours.
Shizu stared at the blade in her hands and vowed to do the gift justice. She would be better than the original dragon. She would make the legend live as it never had before. Sensei gently took the weapon from her, sliding the blade back into the scabbard and returning the sword to the rack behind him.
It is there for you when you need it.
He moved to stand before her again, his gaze capturing her own.
I have one more gift for you.
Stepping in close, he bent his head. He kissed her passionately on the lips. For a moment, she froze in shock. And then the hunger and passion she had been hiding inside for years exploded. She clung to him, losing herself in his touch and his taste and his very closeness. Her love for him knew no bounds, and she had prayed for years that this day would come, but had never actually believed that it would. His hands found the ties of her kimono and deftly released them, sliding the garment off her shoulders to let it pool on the floor at her feet. His lips traced their way down her neck, and Shizu nearly screamed in delight. Sensei took her on the floor of the dojo. When he was finished, he left her alone. He had won her over, heart, mind, and soul. She would do whatever he asked, whenever he asked, without hesitation or doubt. When he summoned her to his study a few hours later, he gave no indication that anything out of the ordinary had happened between them. Recognizing what she thought was his need for discretion, Shizu did not refer to it either. It would be their secret. Sensei handed her a file folder. Inside was a color photo of a stunningly beautiful woman with chestnut hair and ambergreen eyes. A name had been printed across the bottom of the photograph.
That woman carries a certain sword that I wish to possess. I want you to get that sword for me.
She'll be dead before the week is out.
No.
No. She is not to come to any harm, nor can the sword be taken from her by force. It must be given of her own free will. Anything less, and my plans will be ruined. Do you understand?
Shizu hid the confusion she was feeling and simply nodded. She had been trained to kill, to eliminate her enemies as ruthlessly and as quickly as possible. The woman had something Sensei wanted, and she was not allowed to use the one skill she could most easily bring to bear on the problem? Was this another test? Sensei saw her confusion.
The sword is an item of considerable power, but that power is only available if its current bearer still lives and if the sword has been given freely. Rather than taken under duress, she must remain alive.
Hi!
Shizu bowed to show her complete agreement. Sensei pointed at some materials in the file folder.
Everything you need is in here. Habits, locations, even her travel schedule for the next several weeks. An account has been opened for your use. The access codes are in the folder as well. Once you have the sword, reach me through the usual channels. I will await word that you have succeeded, as I have no doubt that you will do so. Good hunting.
Later, in her own room, Shizu stared at the photograph, studying the woman. Her gaze drifted to the name at the bottom of the page.
What secrets are you hiding, Anya Creed? And why is preserving your life so important to Sensei?
She did not know the answers, but she was certain she would find out. Maybe then she could quench the fire of jealousy that was suddenly burning in her heart. Anya slept badly that night, her dreams plagued by faceless samurai soldiers and a massive feathered dragon that breathed fire in great scorching arcs. Rue appeared more than once as well, a gagged and bound captive who endured torture after torture at the hands of a beautiful porcelain doll with long, dark hair. By the time she awoke for the fifth time, heart pounding, Anya decided that it wasn't worth trying to sleep anymore. She got up to greet the sun. She ran through a series of katas to get her blood flowing and her head clear, then settled down in front of the windows. The sun kissed the rooftops nearby, then rose high enough to shine its light directly into her loft, illuminating her as she sat lotus-style on the floor. Satisfied that she was ready for what was to come later in the day, Anya got up, showered, and ate a hearty breakfast, knowing she was going to need the energy reserves later. All the while, her thoughts were on her sword. The plan called for her to give it up to the dragon and do what she could to hold it here in this world as she and Henshaw tried to free Rue. Then she would call the sword back to her, ultimately returning it to the Otherwhere. It wasn't half bad as plans go. There was only one thing wrong with it. They had no idea what would happen when she voluntarily gave up the sword. Would it still be bonded to her at that point? Would the link between them be shattered? Would she ever be able to command the sword again? She didn't know. And not knowing scared her. Henshaw arrived at the park just after it opened. He carried a backpack over one shoulder and had several cameras slung around his neck, emulating the look of just another picture-obsessed photographer come to document the beauty of the garden in bloom. A tour bus with New Jersey license plates was unloading passengers as he approached the entrance to the park, so he merged with the crowd.
Pardon me, is this the line for purchasing?
If the park was under surveillance, as Anya suspected, then they would be looking for a solitary individual and might not pay too much attention to the group as it entered the park. Henshaw stayed with his newfound friend until they had moved through the entrance pavilion and into the park itself.
A pleasure meeting you. Yeah,
then he wandered away on his own. When he was certain that no one was taking an undue interest in him, Henshaw took out the little map he'd been given when he'd bought his ticket and quickly located the Japanese Hill and Pond Garden. He'd entered off Flatbush Avenue, which was on the opposite end of the park from where he needed to be. It seemed a prudent move. The two entrances off Washington were certainly closer, but they were also more likely to be watched for just that reason. In order to get to the Japanese Garden, he was going to have to stick to the outer walkway, past the Steinhardt Conservatory, the Lilypool Terrace, and the Magnolia Plaza Visitor Center before he was even close. From there, he could cut through the Celebrity Path or the Fragrance Garden to reach his destination. Henshaw took his time, using his cameras on a regular basis, doing what he could to remain in character and not appear out of place. Several passers-by smiled and greeted him. He nodded or waved hello in return, but kept his mouth shut at all times. He didn't want people to remember the man with all the cameras and the British accent, just in case something went wrong later. At last, he reached the southern edge of the lake. The viewing pavilion was directly in front of him. This was the location of the meet. He had to find a suitable watching place. He consulted his map and tried to match it up with his surroundings. He could see that on the other side of the narrow lake, the land began to rise toward a wooded ridgeline. A second path wound along about halfway up the hillside, and he decided to follow that to see what he might find. Another 10 minutes of walking found him looking directly back across the lake at the viewing pavilion from that second, higher walkway. This is the place, he thought. He left the path and climbed through the trees, emerging on a narrow ridge above the edge of the Japanese garden. From there, he could look across the lake to the viewing pavilion, as well as both walkways, the one on this side of the lake and the other that led up to and away from the pavilion itself. He found a small copse of trees that provided him a clear line of sight to the pavilion as well as some shade. Setting his pack on the ground, he walked 50 paces in every direction, looking back at his selected spot from a variety of locations. He was pleased to find that he couldn't see the backpack no matter how hard he tried. The position was a good one and would provide the cover he needed to carry out his part of the plan. Later, when the sun was setting, the whole area would be layered with shadows and he'd be almost invisible. Returning to his chosen location, he removed a pair of binoculars from his pack, found a comfortable sitting position with his back to a tree, and settled in to start his watch. By mid-morning, Anya was going stir-crazy. When something needed to be done, she was the type who just went out and did it, so waiting around was driving her nuts. She paced the floor of her loft like a caged lioness back and forth until she just couldn't take it anymore. She had to get out of there. She threw on her sweats and went for a jog, sticking to the main streets and avoiding any of the alleys or shortcuts she might have used. She wanted to be certain she was around people in case the dragon's goons tried to make another move ahead of the meet. When she returned to her apartment, she showered for the second time that morning and then dropped in front of the television in her bathrobe for some mindless entertainment. Halfway through whatever show it was that she was watching, it was that interesting, she decided to call Garin. If there was one thing Garin was good at, it was self-preservation. Since both he and Rue were tied to Joan's sword in some indefinable way, she knew he would want to be kept abreast of what was happening. He'd also want to know what had happened to Rue. Just because their last encounter had ended badly didn't mean that they wanted nothing further to do with each other. If that was the case, they would have stopped talking to each other hundreds of years ago. Anya dialed the cell number she had for Garin. The call was finally routed to a general voicemail system. There wasn't even a message. It just beeped to indicate that it was recording. She left a message explaining that Rue was in trouble and that she needed Garin's help. After that, there wasn't anything more she could do. The hours passed slowly. The park had a fair number of visitors, and Henshaw watched them all in turn, looking for that one telltale sign that something was out of place. The one little detail that would give them away for who they really were. But he didn't see anything that made him suspicious. He found himself admiring the tranquility of the place, the calmness of the lake waters, the gentle cascade of the landscape. Even the soft breeze that wafted over the garden seemed to have been designed to enhance its very features. Several times he saw solitary figures showing interest in the lake and the viewing pavilion. One even took the time to pace off the inside of the structure. But when the bride and groom showed up 15 minutes later for the picture-taking ceremony, Henshaw knew the photographer was just that, a photographer, and not a threat. Around noon, two men in a small boat paddled out across the surface of the lake to where an odd-looking wooden gate-like structure floated. Henshaw had noted it when he'd first caught sight of the lake, and the brochure he'd been given with his entrance ticket had told him that it was known as a torii. It had been painted such a brilliant shade of red that the eye couldn't help but be drawn to it amid the deep emerald green of the surrounding trees. The men in the boat seemed to be checking something at the base of the torii. Probably a pair of maintenance men, he thought, and after growing tired of watching them, eventually dismissed them as unimportant. He barely noticed when they left a few minutes later. Not once during the long afternoon did anyone glance in his direction, never mind leave the path and climb up toward the ridge where he might have been in danger of being seen. Nor did he see anything suspicious. If the dragon or her people were out there, they were doing one hell of a job of staying hidden. Eventually, the sun began to set, and the time for Anya's arrival drew near. Confident that the shadows now hid him sufficiently well that he wouldn't be seen even if he stood, Henshaw reached for his backpack. He removed what he needed, and then assembled it carefully. When he was finished, he took the spotting scope out of the pocket of his shirt where he had been carrying it all day, and clamped it on to the barrel of the now reassembled rifle. He was ready.
Hang in there, sir. We're coming.
When the time had come, Anya dressed in a pair of jeans, a long-sleeved jersey, and her usual low-cut hiking boots. She put the receiver in her ear and attached the microphone to the space between her breasts, just below her collarbone. Then she caught a cab over to the garden. Founded in 1910 on the site of a former ash dump, the Brooklyn Botanic Garden occupied 52 acres between Washington and Flatbush Avenues near the Prospect Heights section of Brooklyn. It held more than 10,000 varieties of plants and welcomed more than 700,000 visitors per year. At least, that's what the sign near the ticket booth read. In all the years Anya had lived in Brooklyn, she'd never been to the gardens.
I have to get out more.
She paid for her ticket and passed through the gates, examining the little map they handed out in the process. She found the section of the park containing the Japanese Hill and Pond Garden and headed in that direction. Wandering down the path a short way from the entrance, she found an isolated spot, and, pretending she needed to retie her shoe, she squatted and tried to reach Henshaw.
Henshaw, you out there?
Right here, Miss Creed.
All right. I'm inside the park. I'll make my way around to the pavilion and see what's what.
It took her 15 minutes to reach the Japanese garden. This particular one was the first Japanese garden built within an American public garden, and its creator, Takeo Shiota, had done the city proud. It blended the ancient hill and pond style with the more modern stroll garden style and managed to carry it off wonderfully. Anya thought the beauty of the place was amazing. Evergreen trees and bushes dominated the landscape, and here and there bright splashes of color from flowering plants were used with restraint. Anya could see a wooden bridge extending out to a small hump of an island that reminded her of a turtle's back, but it was the building standing right at the water's edge that drew her like iron to a magnet. The viewing pavilion was a large wooden pagoda-like structure made in typical Japanese fashion. The wood had been stained a deep brown and stood out against the trees without being conspicuous or seeming to be out of place. A vermilion-colored torii, or floating gateway, could be seen in the middle of the lake. Anya knew that the torii indicated the presence of a shrine somewhere nearby, but when she looked around for it, she couldn't see it. She walked over to the pavilion and entered. It appeared to be empty, just one large room without furniture, but which offered several places from which one could look out upon the lake.
Still with me?
I'm here. Looks like you're about to get company. Someone is approaching from the opposite entrance.
Anya waited a moment, then turned to face that direction, just in time to see Shizu walking toward the pavilion. Henshaw brought the rifle to his shoulder and centered the sights on the dragon as she approached Anya. Henshaw whirled around, thinking he'd find a stray hiker or a runaway dog. Instead, he saw a figure standing in the shadows not half a dozen yards away. The gun in his hand was a dead giveaway that he didn't have Henshaw's best interests at heart. Henshaw couldn't believe what he was seeing. He'd been so careful all day long, so intent on making certain he wasn't seen, that his mind just couldn't accept that someone else had gotten the drop on him. He made an effort to get his gun up and around in the right direction. He went over backward, the darkness already closing in. Henshaw had a moment to wonder about the lack of the sound of the gunshots. Then the darkness closed in, and he knew no more. Anya watched as the dragon seemed to step right out of the shadows as she entered the building. Shizu glanced around, saw Anya, and began walking toward her.
Here she comes. Be ready. Henshaw?
By that time, the dragon was too close for Anya to take a chance with another message. She'd just have to hope that he'd heard. It wasn't an auspicious beginning. The dragon stopped about 10 feet away from Anya, and the two women looked each other over. Gone was the slightly over-the-top fan from the other day. Anya could see that in her place was a stone-cold killer with dead, flat eyes. She was dressed in loosely fitting dark clothing that Anya knew had been chosen not just to allow for ease of movement, but also to hide her amid the shadows that were settling all around them now. The hilt of a sword rose up and over the edge of one shoulder.
Where's Rue?
He's here. You'll be reunited with him in a moment. Where's the sword?
Knowing that only one of them was going to make it out of this encounter alive, Anya didn't care about the dragon seeing the truth, and so she reached into the otherwhere. The tip of the blade pointed directly at the dragon's throat. Shizu's face showed surprise, though it was masked very quickly. Anya had seen it, though, and she wondered about it. Did the dragon's sword operate differently? Is that why she wore it openly on her back rather than letting it rest in the otherwhere? Or was it all just a trick to throw her off the track, to lull her into making a mistake? The dragon made a strange flicking motion with her hand, and suddenly there was a pistol in it. She pointed it at Anya.
Put the sword down on the ground.
No, not until I know where Rue is.
I told you, he's nearby. You'll see him soon enough. It would be a shame to mess up those pretty features.
This was one of the prearranged signals she and Henshaw had come up with for when they were in the thick of things. This particular one meant that he was to put a warning shot right across her bow to show the dragon that she wasn't the only one with arms and support. Nothing happened. Still nothing. Apparently, she was on her own. Anya suddenly felt very inadequate for the situation she faced. The dragon chambered around.
I said, put the sword down.
Not seeing any other alternative, Anya did as she was told. She put the sword on the ground and willed it to remain and not vanish into the otherwhere.
Now, move over there.
The dragon pointed with the barrel of the gun to where a screen in the side of the pavilion had been pulled back, revealing a small balcony overlooking the lake. Slowly, Anya did as she was told. While she watched her enemy, she also continued concentrating on keeping the sword in the here and now. Having it disappear into the otherwhere would probably earn her a bullet in the head. The dragon kept her distance as she circled toward where the sword rested on the ground. By the time Anya reached the balcony, the dragon was standing over the sword. She bent over, slid it into a cloth sheath that she'd produced from somewhere on her person, and slung the entire package over her back next to her own weapon.
We had a deal. The sword for Rue.
Look to your left. Do you see the line tied to the railing?
Yes, I see it.
It was a narrow piece of fishing line, nearly invisible in the fading sunlight, tied off at the railing and disappearing out into the pond.
Untie it and pull on it.
Anya eyed her warily, but made no move toward the line. The gun swiveled in her direction again.
I said, pull on it.
Anya didn't see that she had a choice, so she stepped closer and began to work at the knot. While she did so, she tried reaching out to Henshaw again.
Are you out there?
She heard nothing. When the line was finally untied, she gave it a good yank. Behind her, out on the water, something moved.
Reel it in.
Again, Anya did as she was told, but this time a cold sense of foreboding was stealing across her body. Something had gone very wrong. It seemed likely that both Henshaw and Rue were already dead, which left her alone to escape the dragon's clutches. It only took a few seconds to reel in the line, and when she did, she discovered that it was attached to a long, hollow reed that resembled nothing so much as a wet piece of narrow bamboo. As she stared at it, something began to churn at the base of the floating Tori E marker in the middle of the lake.
I promised I'd deliver Rue alive and unharmed. I always keep my promises. It's just too bad that you're the one who just took his air hose out of his mouth. Old guy like that, he probably won't last 2 minutes.
As Anya made the connection between the long, narrow reed in her hand and the churning commotion in the middle of the pond, she backed up, took 3 running steps, and dove over the railing into the lake. She struck the water in a shallow dive and let the momentum carry her along as far as it could before she surfaced and swam toward the floating Torii with hard strokes of her arms and legs. As she drew closer to the floating signpost, Anya ducked below the surface. The Torii wasn't actually floating, she discovered, but was held in place by a long shaft that was sunk several feet into the muck-covered bottom of the pond. Rue was tied to that shaft. He was flailing, trying desperately to get himself free as he fought to hold his breath. She surfaced, grabbed another lungful of air, and then shot back down to help Rue. Up close, she discovered she'd been wrong. Rue wasn't tied to the shaft. He was chained. A shiny steel chain was attached to the pole and then wrapped around his body several times, securing him in place. It was all held together by a thick brass lock. As she swam in close to the shaft, she held onto the chain with her left hand, opened her right hand, and summoned her sword. She jammed the blade down between the first loop of the chain and the pole itself, and then pulled against it with all her strength. The link snapped quickly. She shot for the surface. Filled her lungs, and then dove back down. Anya could see that Rue had stopped struggling. He was just hanging there in the chains, his mouth open and filled with water. She repeated what she had done before, sliding the sword between the pole and the links of the chain. Planting her feet against the pole, she hauled down on the sword with all of her might. Several links of chain parted, and Rue's body began to slip downward toward the bottom of the pond. Anya dropped her sword and grabbed for him before he could drift out of reach. Hugging him to her, she kicked for the surface. With her arms wrapped around his chest from behind and his head resting in the crook between her shoulder and neck, Anya struggled to get Rue to shore. Eventually, her feet found the bottom and she stood, relieving her back of some of the burden. She dragged him up and onto the shore. And laid him flat on the ground. His face had been severely beaten, and the right side was so swollen that his eye was barely visible. The fingers on one hand were broken, and it felt as though his shoulder was dislocated. She rolled him on his side to let some of the water drain out of his lungs and then set to work. It had been a while since she'd had any formal CPR training.
Tilt the head, pinch the nose, and breathe.
His lips were cold and hard beneath her own. She could taste the brackishness of the pond water.
Check for air.
She put her ear in front of his nose, hoping for an exhale. Nothing.
Hands on the chest. Pump. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15.
Nothing.
Come on, old man.
She went back to breathing again. Rue couldn't die like this. Not drowned while chained to a pole in a public park. Not sacrificed so that someone else could be the new bearer of Joan's sword. Not because she had failed him when he needed her most.
15. Don't die on me, Rue. Not yet. Breathe, damn you.
Rue suddenly convulsed, coughing up what looked to her to be half the water in the pond behind them. She quickly rolled him on his side. Pounded on his back, she helping him evacuate the water from his lungs. After a moment, he opened his eyes and blinked up at her.
Did you kill her?
Not yet.
I heard them talking before they... This shrine is their rendezvous.
The one behind us here in the woods?
Rue nodded, then turned his head. When he had cleared his throat, he looked up and realized Anya was still there watching him.
Well, what are you waiting for?
You sure you'll be all right?
Fine.
As he retched up more pond water, she reached for him, but he waved her off.
Go! She has to be stopped.
Anya went. The sun had set while she'd been in the water with Rue, and it was fully dark. The old-fashioned street lamps that lined the walkways had come on with the growing dark, and now lit the path with a soft light. She followed the path a short distance until she came to a fork in the road. A little sign stood nearby, with an arrow pointing down each arm of the fork. The first was directed to the right, and the word shrine had been etched into its surface. It didn't take her long to spot the small structure set back in its own nook amid the white pines. It was made from wood and had a green-tiled roof that made it seem as if the structure itself had simply grown out of the ground, rather than having been built by human hands. Leaving the pathway, Anya crept through the trees until she had a clear view of the front of the shrine. Four steps led up to the entrance. Beside the steps was a pair of stone foxes, symbols of Inari, god of the harvest. Anya stealthily walked to the front of the building, calmly climbed the steps, and entered through the front door. The interior of the shrine was lit by an entire wall of candles. By their light, Anya could see the dragon conferring with two men dressed in the uniforms of the park maintenance crew. As one, they turned to look at her.
You can't have the sword.
Do you think you can take it from me?
Oh, I think so.
Anya smiled, and by the way the two men stepped back upon seeing it, she knew she had conveyed her intent clearly enough. The dragon's eyes fell on the sword, and then on the wrapped bundle she had set aside several minutes before.
Kill her!
She drew her own sword with a lightning-quick maneuver. The men rushed toward Anya with their own weapons drawn. She met the first of the dragon's henchmen in the center of the room. He came forward with clumsy overhand attacks that Anya had no problem avoiding. Anya deflected the swing of his sword and continued to turn, spinning around to bring her left elbow smashing into his temple. He stumbled backward, dropping his sword in the process. Anya moved in on him, kicking his sword away as she did so. He turned to run. She slashed her blade across the backs of his knees, cutting his hamstrings and effectively taking him out of the fight. A knife flew by Anya's head, taking her attention away from the downed man at her feet. The other man was standing where the other had been originally. But rather than facing her with sword in hand, he was pulling knife after knife from slots on his belt and hurling them at her. She used her sword to knock them out of the air as she advanced. When she reached him, he drew his own sword and put up an inspired defense. The end result was the same. Anya shortly found herself standing over his dying form, the blade of her sword slick with the man's blood. Anya looked around, just as the dragon came running out of the shadows, sword in hand. Only the fact that Anya stumbled over something on the floor kept her from losing her head. They moved around the interior of the shrine, trading blow after blow. Eventually, the battle began to wear on Anya. The Shizu was fresh, Anya was not. Her timing was off. Her attacks were a split second too slow and getting slower all the while. Sensing this, the dragon pressed her attack, driving Anya back. Step after step, blow after blow, Anya could do nothing but retreat. The dragon chose that moment to smile at her, and Anya felt a newfound strength pour through her limbs as adrenaline flooded her system. This time it was the dragon who was forced back. The dragon came out of the exchange bleeding as the tip of Anya's sword slashed her skin when she failed to move fast enough. It looked as if it would be the dragon who lost the battle, and apparently the dragon thought so too. She maneuvered her way around the building until she stood in front of the stairs leading back down to ground level. After delivering a powerful blow, she turned and ran down the stairs. By the time Anya managed to get outside, the dragon had disappeared into the trees. Anya caught the barest glimpse of her just before she was lost from sight, and without hesitation, Anya raced to catch up. There was no path, no easy route, and Anya was forced to push her way through the branches. Eventually, she emerged from the trees. She found herself standing near what could only be the Cherry Esplanade. It was a wide-open area on which 76 individual cherry trees had been planted in four identical rows, leaving a wide carpet of green grass in the center. Large spotlights had been set up all around the edges of the esplanade, illuminating it even though the park was closed. The cherry blossoms were in full bloom, and in their midst, death awaited her. The dragon stood in the center of the grass. In her hand, she held the Muramasa blade, the 10,000 cold knights that Garin claimed was the dark counterpart to Anya's own sword. She stalked forward onto the field, coming to a halt several yards away from her enemy. The dragon looked at her through narrowed eyes.
Surrender the sword, and I shall let you live.
Anya shook her head. The dragon launched herself at Anya, her sword coming around and down toward Anya's unprotected flesh. Anya moved several feet to the right. The dragon was on her in an instant. Slash and parry, cut and jab, back and forth they went, neither of them gaining any significant advantage. They broke apart, gaining a momentary respite. Anya tried circling to her left, watching Shizu closely. The dragon was doing the same. Shizu exploded in movement, her weapon swinging toward Anya's midsection in a vicious strike. Anya dropped the point of her sword and met Shizu's blade with the edge of her own. She twisted and brought her own weapon around in an arc that was aimed at the dragon's midsection. But Shizu danced out of range on nimble feet. Back and forth they went, blow after blow, twisting and turning, moving across the glass, each of them striving to gain the upper hand and deliver the winning blow. It was Shizu who drew first blood, cutting in beneath Anya's guard and slashing the tip of her sword across Anya's shoulder.
The beginning of the end.
Shizu came at her again, and they traded another series of blows. This time, when the dragon stepped in close, Anya lashed out with her leg, striking the dragon straight in the chest and causing her to stumble backward. Anya kept up her forward momentum, driving the dragon back across the field with a combination of sword fighting and martial arts moves, throwing out strikes and kicks between sword blows. Finally, the dragon began to tire. She came in with a new overhand blow as Anya shifted her hold on her weapon and struck out at the hilt of her enemies. Their swords slammed together, and the Muramasa blade flew out of Shizu's grasp, tumbling through the air. The dragon was shocked. She turned her head to watch the blade go flying from her. As Shizu looked away, Anya's broadsword thrust into her body between the third and fourth ribs and exited out the back just to the right of her spine. Anya released her sword and stepped back. The dragon tottered for a moment and then sank slowly to her knees. Her bloody hands searched for and found the hilt of Anya's weapon, but without the strength to pull it free.
How did you take this sword from me?
Her eyes glazed over, and she crumpled to the ground. The dragon was dead. Anya's sword vanished back into the otherware, ready for the next time Anya would need it. Anya knew she should have felt satisfaction at the end result, but all she could think about was that final question. She didn't understand. She knew instinctively that the dragon had not been talking about her own weapon, but about how Anya's sword had vanished right out of the dragon's very hands. And that didn't make any sense. How could the dragon not know about the sword's ability to vanish and reappear at will? Surely the weapon the dragon carried had been able to do the same. Anya looked across the field, expecting the dragon's weapon to have vanished the minute its wielder died, only to find it right where it had fallen, jammed point first into the earth about 10 feet away. For a long moment, Anya couldn't look away. The sword was still there, her thoughts churning at the implications. Anya climbed to her feet and cautiously approached it. The sword was as she remembered it, right down to the etching of the dragon on the surface of the blade just below the hilt. Even now, the etching seemed to be snarling in defiance. Reaching out, afraid of what might happen should she touch it, but needing to know nonetheless, she wrapped her hand around the hilt. Nothing happened. Where she expected to feel something from the blade, some sense of its bloody history and evil reputation, she felt nothing. It was just a sword, an inert piece of metal. While it might have historical value, there was nothing otherwise special about the weapon. Garin and Rue had been wrong. Priceless historical artifact it might be, but that was all. The only mystical sword Anya knew of was the one she carried. Epilogue. From the shadows beyond the rows of cherry trees at the edge of the esplanade, Garin Braden watched as the woman his agent had selected to be trained specifically for this day, for this very battle, fell beneath the point of Anya's sword.
Damn it. This was not the way things were supposed to end.
No longer content to leave the sword, and hence his future, in the hands of anyone other than himself, Garin had carefully planned and orchestrated events for years to arrive at this point in time. After going through his myriad contacts throughout Europe and Asia, he'd entrusted the deed to the mysterious fixer known throughout the Japanese underworld only as the Sensei, and provided him with the necessary funds and resources to carry out his wishes. Originally created to eliminate Rue, Sensei's training of his beautiful assassin had been redirected when Anya had reunited the pieces of Joan's shattered sword, irrevocably changing the status quo. Garin had adapted, however, and modified his goals. His intent to steal the sword for himself and eliminate both his former mentor and his mentor's new protege had seemed flawless. But apparently, he'd done something that he kept telling himself not to do. He'd underestimated Anya Creed. Both she and Rue still lived, while the blood of Garin's carefully groomed champion pooled upon the ground at Anya's feet, beneath the beauty of the cherry blossoms. How poetic, he thought in disgust. To add insult to injury, he'd even let that bastard Henshaw live. His two shots had been true, But when he'd checked the body, he'd discovered that Henshaw had been wearing a protective vest. He was unconscious rather than dead. All Garin had to do to eliminate a future threat was put one more bullet through the man's skull, but the previous shot had ruined his silencer, and he hadn't wanted to alert Anya that her partner was in trouble. He'd let the man live, and might someday regret it. No matter, he thought. There will be another time, another opportunity. He was sure of it. Just as he was sure that he and Anya Creed would one day face each other over that sword. And on that day, Garin Braden intended to come out on top.
Rogue Angel, The Dragon's Mark is a graphic audio production. Rogue Angel trademark owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited. Used by others under license. Copyright 2010, Worldwide Library. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Yasmin Toison, Eric Messner, Richard Rowan, Michael Glenn, Terrence Aselford, Christopher Sheeran, Margie Tompros, Tony Nam, Thomas Penny, James Lewis, Tom Simpson, Dan Stevens, Ken Jackson, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Ken Jackson. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Allison Thomas. The Rogue Angel theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Additional original music by Dan Sondak. Book adapted for graphic audio by Doug Krensland. If you enjoyed Rogue Angel, be sure to look for Lilith St. Croix's Dante Valentine series and Elizabeth Moon's Vada's War. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Available now in graphic audio.
Graphic audio presents DC Comics, Green Lantern, Sleepers, Book 3.
Wait, you're a Green Lantern, right? You can't!
The spirit of vengeance has come for you, Detective.
The world, the universe, something's wrong.
Of course it is.
How do you know?
If it wasn't, neither of us would dress this way.
I'm human again. This is how it starts, isn't it?
What the hell is going on?
Best I can tell, pal, the apocalypse.
Cal, what happened?
Hal Jordan tried to kill me.
Jade, Kyle's ring has security lockouts that prevent others from using it. The only person who could possibly use it is the ring's original owner.
That man is a killer, and now you want me to just give him Kyle's ring?
Kyle battled one sleeper and almost lost the solar system. We're facing thousands.
Promise me you won't go insane and destroy entire planets again.
I can't.
Oh my god.
It's the JLA. They're all sleepers.
And so Hal Jordan dies, and Sinestro lives!
Green Lantern and all names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics. Copyright 2011, all rights reserved.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.